I want to ask you a question this morning, and that is this. What vices do you have that if you don't protect yourself from them, you know you'll give in to temptation? Now, I have an image of a cookie jar there and a chain around it because, you know, for some of us, it might be that simple. I need to be honest. If I have ice cream in the house and I know it, I will plow through that thing faster than I should. You know, I mean, I don't go for the little bowls. I go for the big bowl. There's no use, you know, skimping when it comes to ice cream. But maybe it's a little bit something more seriously, you know, maybe you struggle with an addiction. And if you're in the presence of a drug or an alcohol, you know that you'll have to give in to that temptation and it can get a control of you and you need to set protection there. Maybe you're addicted to porn and even just have to be careful about when you surf and using different protections because you know that the temptation is there and it can grab a hold of you. Maybe it's even just something as simple as realizing the amount of time that you can be sucked when you get on Facebook or Twitter or social media and how that can even have an effect when you look at everybody else's life and you look at all the good things that they post. Of course, we never post the bad things usually, but the good things and you compare it to yours and you can feel the weight of that you kind of downplay your life and you see the bad in it. Or if you don't get the number of likes that you want, it can have an effect on you. It has that kind of a drug almost effect. Maybe it's even just that person at school or at work that has that knows how to push your buttons. You know that if they come to you and if they talk to you and they have just that tone or if they say a certain thing, that can set you off. And so you need to be careful around them. I want you to think about that because today we are going through the book of Exodus and we find ourselves in Exodus 23, verse 20 and 23 today, through 33 today. And in this section, we're going to see that what God is trying to do is protect the people of Israel from temptation and from evil. So when we come to this text and when we read it, I want you with that mindset because some of the things that he says might kind of rub us the wrong way and they might kind of sit here and go, well, is this really necessary? But I want you to have this mindset of a loving father trying to protect his kids from things he knows have that potential to have that kind of vice to them. So it's really important that when you hear this stuff that you have this kind of a mindset. We're at the end of the book of the covenant. That's a section here in Exodus that we find ourselves. And really what it is, and is an agreement of God and his people, and he lays out kind of what it's supposed to be. If you want to be a follower of me, this is what it includes. And we've looked at the list of laws, and that's where we're at. A list of these things, kind of fleshing out the Ten Commandments. And in the end, we're getting to this section where he lays not just the feasts or the laws or that kind of stuff, but it closes, and he looks with a series of warnings for disobedience and rewards for obedience. And so this kind of gives you the background of where we're at as we look at the text. But if you want to turn with me in your Bibles, you can see the pages there. There's also, we have YouVersion notes and text online if you want to use that app as well. But this is the word of the Lord. See, I'm sending an angel ahead of you to guard you along the way and to bring you to the place I have prepared. Pay attention to him and listen to what he says. Do not rebel against him. He will not forgive your rebellion since my name is in him. If you listen carefully to what he says and do all I say, I will be an enemy to your enemies and oppose those who oppose you. My angel will go ahead of you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will wipe them out. Do not bow down before their gods and worship them or follow their practices. You must demolish them and break their sacred stones to pieces. Worship the Lord your God, and his blessing will be on your food and water, and I will take away sickness from among you, and none will miscarry or be barren in your land, and I will give you a full lifespan. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion every nation you encounter, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs and run. I will send the hornet ahead of you to drive the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites out of your way. But I will not drive them out in a single year, because the land would become desolate and wild animals too numerous for you. Little by little, I will drive them out before you until you have increased enough to take possession of the land. And I will establish your borders from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea and from the desert to the Euphrates River. And I will give into your hands the people who live in the land, and you will drive them out before you. Do not make a covenant with them or with their gods, and do not let them live in your land, or they will cause you to sin against me, because the worship of their gods will certainly be a snare to you. Now, before we kind of look at the two main themes, I think, that are in this text, I think it's important for us to get the context. And I hinted at that a little bit here in the opening before this. We are looking at the end of a covenant or a contract. And it is set up. God's laid it out ahead of time. If you want to be my people and I'm going to be your God, this is the life that I want you to live. And the life that he wants them to live is following the Ten Commandments and all these other laws. And we looked at the festivals last week. And so today he says, if this is the life you're going to live, then there's going to be some consequences. And this is the way the treaties of the day were established, the covenants there. And so he says, there's some warnings against disobedience and some rewards for obedience. And so this is really kind of where we find ourselves. We're at the end of this whole section. And I think this is important to note, because if we look at these certain verses, and there's two I want to highlight in particular, the warning and also the reward, out of context, then we can think that it says things that it doesn't. And so the context here is very important. And the first one I want to note is in Exodus 23, verse 21, where God uses really strong language. He says, pay attention to him and listen to what he says. Do not rebel against him, for he will not forgive your rebellion. Now, I don't know about you, but that kind of irks me a little bit. I think of God as a gracious God and a loving God. And that's true. He is. We're going to actually see the tabernacle will point that out. We're literally for 10 chapters in the next section, we're going to look at it in Lent and see how every one of these elements of the tabernacle points to God's grace if people admit that they've blown it and they're in need of God's redemption. But we need to look at this verse in context, because the context is that of a warning. If you guys listen to me even this morning, I'm here by myself. My youngest daughter is sick, and my oldest daughter needed to go where she needed to go, and I gave her a warning. Either you come and follow me because dad's in a hurry, or you're going to face some, and you can listen to me, and you can sit where you want to sit, or if you don't listen to me right now, you're going to have to sit where I tell you, right? I don't go, hey, I love you, and I will always love you, and I will unconditionally love you, and I want you to obey me because I know that that's best for you. That's true. I will say that to her, especially when my kids, if I have to discipline them, and we're in that spot of repairing our relationship, I will tell them over and over again. I have a saying, I love you when you're happy, I love you when you're sad. I love you when you're silly, I love you when you're mad. I love you when you're good, and I love you when you're bad. I love you all the time, always. And I tell them that at night, and I tell them that when I have to repair their relationship after I do have to discipline them, because I want them to know the unconditional love. But I don't lead with that when I'm in the midst of a warning, right? Hey, I'm going to love you no matter what. So just, even if you obey or disobey. So I really want you to do this. Just do that. It doesn't have that kind of ring, right? No, I say, hey, I need you to go over here. Go here now. And if you don't, there's going to be consequences. That's the kind of language I use. And so we need to look at that in context. This is the context of the end of a covenant, where God lays out warnings, and he's having that kind of language with his people, saying, look, he wants them to follow you, but you need to understand that not following me has consequences. And so we need to see that in the context of the whole book in order to get the proper understanding of who it is. And as I said, actually starting not next week, but after the week after that, we're going to look at every single one of the elements of the tabernacle and look how they point to Christ's sacrifice and how they show this bigger story of redemption that's in the Bible. But the other side that we need to look at isn't just in the warning. We also need to look at it in the reward. Because God promises material blessings to the Israelites after they enter the land. It says, worship the Lord your God, and his blessing will be on your food and water. And I will take away sickness from among you, and none will miscarry or be burdened or be barren in the land. And I will give you a full lifespan. Now, when we look at this, it's easy for us to sometimes say, well, they're the people of God in his time, and we're the people of God in the New Testament, and so this can apply to us. And sometimes we can look at that and look at our own lives and say, well, I'm not sick. I mean, my wife and I, we aren't able to have kids. We're barren. That's why we run Club Hope here at Crossway Church, and why we adopted both of my kids. So does that mean that we're not necessarily living the life, and that's our punishment? Well, no. What it really means is that this promise is in a very specific time, in a very specific setting. And what it is that God promised these material blessings to the Israelites after they enter the land to show the world around them that, guess what? These people are the followers of Yahweh, the creator God of the universe, who is greater than any of these little idols or demigods or fake gods that you worship. And one of the ways that he shows this is by showing them the blessings that are there. How do we know that that's the case, that that just applies over there and not to the New Testament? Well, let's look at what Jesus says. I mean, Exodus 23:25 doesn't imply that Christians who obey God will always be healthy and get what they want. Jesus says later, if you want to follow me, you need to pick up your cross and follow me. And picking up your cross isn't an easy thing. And he says, for whoever would save his life would lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And so we know that this applies to a very specific situation and not across the board. And now, why do I say that? Because sometimes if we come from more of a health and wealth gospel, a verse like this, we can be used as a bully, or as a billy club against those and say, you know, the reason why you're sick, the reason why you're dealing with this. And trust me, I've been told this. When I share the story of our infertility, they say, you know, well, I just prayed good enough and I had enough faith and we automatically had a baby. And they quote verses like this. So can you tell I'm a little passionate? You know, it's not that we can't necessarily look and that God can bless us and God does bless us, but we can't use this as a use of saying, hey, look, this is, if you're not living a certain way, it's because you're getting the sickness or these other things, because that's not the case, because that's speaking to a particular context and highlighting a particular thing. It doesn't cross the board. And we see that the way that Jesus talks in the New Testament. See, that's my trigger. Can you tell? You know, I got to watch it with those people because they trigger me, that I don't become pastor and respond graciously. Instead, I want to stick it to them and say, you don't understand. I say that anyway. I just do it in a gracious way. But there's other lessons that we can learn from here. And I think there's two that are really important that do apply to our lives here today. And the first one is that evil is not something that we can mess with. And we need to be careful about that. And we need to have not just only a high view of God, but we need to have a high view of evil and not underestimate the impact that it has. I'll never forget when I was in eighth grade, my dad went on a business trip and he was able to get really cheap tickets to Europe. And so my mom and my dad got to go with him, and that was my eighth grade graduation trip. And one of the things that we did is we went into a concentration camp, the Dachau one, because this is before the Iron Curtain had fallen. And so there's East Germany and Poland. You couldn't get into some of the more famous ones. And we went to Dachau. And I got to tell you, going to Dachau has had a major impact on my life. That freshman year, I wrote a paper all about World War II, and I've been a World War II buff ever since. Because it's a powerful story of the people of the world joining forces against the evil presence of the Nazi regime and of Hitler. And I can remember walking around this concentration camp, and they literally had kids from the school who were doing the tour, and not ever seeing it be so silent. It was eerily silent. And it's because we all understood the atrocities that took place there. And as we toured the grounds, and as we walked and saw the bunks, as we literally went to the cremation site and the gas chambers, and as we saw the photos, and I didn't put them up here because they're horrendous, of the bodies just literally piled, and you hear of the terrible things the Nazi did, of just one big mass grave and lining everybody up and shooting them so that they would just fall down on top of everybody else and not caring if they actually killed somebody or not. I mean, it's horrendous. And when you hear that evil, you know that you want to do something to stop it. And the Allied soldiers got it. Well, when we come to passages like this and we hear about God wiping out people, it can kind of make us wonder, well, what's going on here? But really the lesson that God wants us to learn here and what we need to see from this text is that evil is nothing to mess around with, and it needs to be stopped and avoided. We see that in this text. He says, look, I'm going to wipe them out. And I think when we envision these people, we don't need to come with rose-colored glasses, that they're just a different race and they're just a different colored people. The Bible makes us clear that these people were ruthless and evil. I mean, a lot of times when it talks about this, God promises to destroy the Canaanites because they did abominable things. They sacrificed their children and their infants to their idols. And you can see this. This isn't just found in the Bible. There's other things where it quotes this as well. Deuteronomy 12:31 says, "You must not worship the Lord your God in this way, because in worshiping their gods, they do all kinds of detestable things the Lord hates. They even burn their sons and daughters in fire as sacrifices for their God." And so we may come to this text and we may see, man, that's pretty extreme, isn't it? I mean, he has to wipe out all the nations and he needs to go to that. But the image I want you to have is the image that I started out with before we looked at this text. It's the image that we need to look at when the Allies came and they attacked the Germans. There was evil, and evil was bad. And he wanted to protect his people from that kind of an influence, and he was willing to do whatever it took to do it. And in the case of World War II, they needed to go in and they needed to find justice for the Nazis and for the atrocities that they had committed. And in this case, that's really what's happening. God is giving justice for the actions of the people. And I know it rubs us the wrong way, because we want everybody to be good, and everybody, we want to give them the benefit of the doubt. But this is really the image we need to have as of this. And I think it helps, the context of that helps us as we kind of wrestle with this. How could God do this? Because it's not an easy thing sometimes. But he really encourages the Israelites to avoid evil. And the premise of avoiding evil is by clinging on to the good. And so over and over again in this text, we see the challenge that, hey, avoid evil by worshiping God alone. I mean, it's repeated there. Sometimes our mindset is, well, how, you know, I mean, I remember as a youth pastor, I still get these kind of questions sometimes as a pastor. I mean, well, how far can I go before it really is a sin? That's the wrong question. How close to God can you be so you don't push the limits, right? I mean, how many of us with our kids, it's like, they know it, you know, you say something and they're like, they're just toying with you. And you remind them, remember what I told you? If you do this, that's going to happen. And we can have that same kind of a mindset to God. And that's why over and over and over again, he says, the way to avoid evil and the way to minimize it is not by getting enthralled by it and getting as close as we can, but rather worshiping God alone. And he says it in two different ways. First, they're commanded to destroy all the Canaanite religious sites. I mean, he says, look, I'm going to send my angel ahead. I'm going to clear out the people, but there's going to be all these things around you that are going to be remaining. And they're going to have their religious sites. They're going to have these temples and these altars where they did these horrendous things. And I want you to completely destroy them, because I don't want any kind of temptation there for you to follow these practices. So I want you to worship me alone. And part of that step is by destroying all these religious sites. You can see that in 24. He says, do not bow down before their gods or worship them or follow their practices. You must demolish them and break their sacred stones to pieces. And this isn't God being angry or he's not afraid that, you know, like these gods will have any kind of competition. He's the creator of the universe and their false deities. There's no comparison. But he knows that if the temptation, if those sites exist, that the temptation to follow them will be strong. And so he says, wipe out everything. Wipe out all their religious sites. Wipe out all their temples. Because the important thing, you need to understand that we need to take evil seriously. And we need, the way to take evil seriously is to worship God alone. And it means get rid of all the potential temptations. The other thing he says is that the Israelites were to limit their interaction with evil people. He says, do not make a covenant with them or their gods. Do not let them live in your land, or they will cause you to sin against me, because the worship of their gods will certainly be a snare to you. Now, as Christians, we are called to be light in darkness. We are called to to be God's presence in a world. And so that doesn't mean that this verse doesn't mean that we necessarily can't have relationships with non-Christians or that we can't have any interaction with them and that we have to huddle all together. I mean, we're called to be light. And one of the ways that we're light is to engage and have relationship with our neighbors, our coworkers, our family members who aren't believers. But when we do that, we also need to be not be naive about the impact that others can have on us. And this passage should really challenge us to think about that. Who are the people that you have in your life that are speaking into your life? Are they believers or are they non-Christians? It's okay to hang out with non-Christians and to have relationships with them. I want you to do that as a pastor because I want you to be in a spot where people look at you and they see something is different about you and the light of that just attracts them and they can tell there's something different. But we also need to be careful that we surround ourselves with those people who are the good influences and that can challenge us and when we fail and call us out when we need it. Not in a judgmental or legalistic way, but in a caring way. Hey, Brad, you're a little short with your kids, you know? I mean, they're five. Cut them a little slack, okay? You know, I mean, we need people to say, you know, I know you didn't mean any harm, but you probably had a little bit more of a sarcastic tone on that comment than you really need to. You know, did you really handle that the way that you should? And the people who are going to do that are the ones who are believers, who hold to the same standards and worship the holy God. They're the ones who are going to do that. And sometimes it's even just being in their presence that you're like, it just raises the bar for you. On the flip side, if all we do is hang out with people who aren't Christians, it's easy for our standards to be lowered. And so we got to be careful about that. It's a balance here. But this passage should challenge us to, one, that we got to take the impact of evil seriously in our lives, and two, impact and realize the impact that people who aren't believers can have on our lives. You know? And we need to make sure that we hang out with the non-Christians and that we have those relationships, but we also need to make sure that the people around us, those who are closest to us, those who we allow to speak into our lives, are also followers of God and give them the impact there. And maybe even have one or two non-Christian friends that are in your close circle. That's fine. But make sure it outweighs, that the Christians outweigh the non-Christians so that we can grow. That's how you grow. Honestly, I want to tell you this. If you want to grow in holiness, one of the ways that you can do it is just by hanging out with people who are holier than you. It's not rocket science. Because you know what? They just have that kind of effect on you. When I was an engineer, I'd swear like even when I was a teenager working at a swimming pool, I could swear like the best of them. I think I overcompensated because I was the only Christian in the group, and that was one of the ways that I tried to show that I was one of them, even though I wasn't. We had radically different lives. I didn't stop swearing by just, you know, hanging out with people who swear. I mean, I can't avoid that. But it was really having people who just showed me, hey, you know what? You don't have to drop an F-bomb everywhere you go to add a little pronunciation to your thing. You can be more articulate than that. You can use other wider vocabulary to punctuate your point. It was seeing other people do that really challenged me to think about that. And so I want you to think about that as we look at this passage. Don't underestimate the impact that evil can have on your life. And we need to be careful. We need to be careful. And we need to make sure that we're not naive about the impact that others can have on us. And really, this text and what God does and the extremes that he goes to should show us that we need to take it seriously. But there's another lesson that we need to do, and I think it's a perfect counterbalance to that. And that is this, that God's always at work in our lives. God is always at work in our lives. We see this. Just look at the sentences in this passage. Look at the subjects. Who does the majority of the work? It's not the humans. It's God. I'm going to do this. I'm going to send the angel. He's going to be the messenger. He's going to be the one who goes ahead of you. He's going to do this. He's going to do this. He's going to do this. And you may not even understand all the ways that he's at work, but I'm guiding him. I'm directing him. I'm doing all this. And that's an important lesson for us to remember, that God is always at work in our lives. And there's two ways that we can see God at work in this passage. The first one is that God ensures victory for the Israelites, and he goes before them in battle. I love what Brian said about the song, "The War is Over," because honestly, when I first looked at it, and when I do what I do, and we do for every song, I look at the lyrics, and I go, okay, how does this line up with Scripture, and how does it work? The line, "The war is over," I thought, well, the war really isn't over. There's still battles going on. But then I thought about it in the context of the song and what it says about how Christ has defeated sin and death on the cross and mercy is extended to us. And in that sense, Christ didn't say on the cross, well, I'm kind of done. What did he say? It's finished, right? It's finished. So when we sing, "The war is over," that's what we're declaring. And so in this passage, we see that that's what God says. He says, look, the battle hasn't even started yet. But I'm going to tell you who's going to be victorious. It's going to be me. Because I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to clear the land and I'm going to fight this battle for you. Because you are my people, and I care for you. There's another thing that God does. God's going to provide the Israelites a permanent home. You know, we kind of broke Exodus in chunks. But we looked at it literally 2 years ago before we picked it up again here in January. And there's a... It let us look at other books in the process, but we kind of forget the grand narrative. And the grand narrative is, these people were slaves in Egypt, and God brought them out of Egypt, and they've been wandering in the wilderness for a long, long time. I don't know how you guys have ever been, but there was a month period in my life where I had to move five times. Well, a three-month period where I moved five times. I quit as a youth pastor, and I went back to school. And so my friend got married, and so I had to give up my lease on a house. Then I had to move in and sleep on a spare room of one of my friends and had all my stuff packed in his garage. And then I was there for a month, and then I moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I did seminary there for 3 months to go through our ordination process. And then I had to move back to my friend's house and sleep on his couch again. And then I worked for UPS for the month of Christmas to earn some money. So I could do that. Then I went to my folks' house and spent Christmas there. And then I came back and I went to Steph's folks' house because we were dating at the time to meet them. And then finally, I ended up back at my friend's house for a little bit before I moved down to Portland. All my stuff is in storage. I'm living out of a suitcase for 3 months. Any of you ever do that? It ain't fun, right? I mean, you have to do it. But when I actually got the U-Haul truck and it was down at my new semi-permanent home for about 8 months before Steph and I got engaged and got an apartment and that and got married and all that. But it was so nice to literally be able to have my clothes in a dresser and to have a permanent home. And the promise that God gives these guys is, I know that you've been wandering, but I'm going to give you a permanent home. Now, why do I bring up these things? Because these things apply to us today. Matter of fact, if you look at the text, I think there's a pretty powerful thing. We mentioned this back in when we looked at the voice coming out of the bush and in other different places. But many scholars believe that the angel or messenger of God could actually be the pre-incarnate Christ. And there's a reason for this. Because if you look at this text clearly, the messenger is differentiated from God, right? Like he says, the messenger is going to be this. And let me just back up a little bit. The reason why I said angel or messenger is because in the text, it's not clear. It's not like a word for angel. It's messenger, and it can imply angel. It may not. But the messenger is always differentiated from God. He speaks there. But at the same time, the messenger has a divine presence. He says, my name is on him. And when it says a name is not just like, hey, my name's Brad. Nice to meet you. You know? No, the name has a huge symbol. It's the presence of God is on him. And even if you look at the interaction of what the angel does and what God does, God flips it back and forth. Well, he's going to do this, but I'm going to do this. And there's this interplay there. And so I personally think that this could, this is my own personal take. I mean, it could just be an angel or not. But I think there's enough proof here for me to say, I think that this could easily be the presence of the pre-incarnate Christ. And if you look at it in that way, and even if it's just the messenger, we see that what God accomplishes in this text has huge implications for us today. Because Christ performs these same things for believers today. Hebrews says, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And if we look at the book of Exodus, our stories match it. Matter of fact, the book of Exodus, the themes of the book of Exodus carry on into the New Testament. And the New Testament authors pick it up because it's the narrative of our lives and of the Bible. And that is this, that you and I were slaves to sin, just like they were slaves in Egypt. But Christ redeemed them by the 10 plagues and sending the absolute worst plague to kill all the firstborns, but sparing the firstborns of Israel. And Pharaoh finally says, get going. And he does this big dramatic thing and frees them and walks them through the Red Sea. And so they're free. And you and I, if we put our hope and trust in Christ, we are free from sin and death. Christ has paid the price for it. And he said, what? It is finished, right? He is victorious over that. But yet, we're in the in-between of what he promises, that he's going to come and make things all new, and that he's going to restore the new heavens and the new earth. And so we're kind of like the Israelites in the wilderness. And the wilderness isn't always fun. We feel the weights of sin. We feel the effects of evil. We see it in our own lives, in the actions that we do, but we feel it in the weight of even in our brokenness, in our pain in our bodies, in the litany of all the things that we went through, and in our actions. And we feel that. And so when we come to this text, we need to remember that God is still at work around us. And even when we don't see them, that he is there. And the first lesson that we need to remind ourselves is that Christ was his victorious death on the cross ensures believers that nothing can separate them from God's love. That's why we can sing, the war is over. Because Christ said, it is finished. And we're still in the desert, and life doesn't go the way we want it to. But God has declared through the words of Christ and what he accomplished on the cross that he is victorious over sin and death. And we need to remind ourselves of that. And so we need to remind ourselves of verses like Romans 8, verses 31 through 39, that says that nothing can separate us from the love of God. Not height, not depth, not angels nor demons, neither death or life. Neither the present nor the future nor any powers can separate us from the love of Christ. Now I'm paraphrasing it. You can read the verse right there, but I got all of them. Nothing. That's as comprehensive of a list as you can. And in those times when we feel the wilderness, when we wonder, where is God in all this? Where is the victory? Because all I'm getting is the squirmishes or the IDs that Lou talked about in the confession. We need to remind ourselves that Christ is victorious. And because he's victorious, nothing can separate us from the love of God. And in those moments, we also need to remind ourselves the other fact, and that is this, that Christ provides believers a permanent heavenly home. Jesus picks up this narrative and this idea of wandering and not having a permanent place to stay in John 14, where he says, do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God and also in me. And my Father's house has many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you with me, that you also may be where I am, and you know to the place where I'm going. And so God makes that same promise to us, that if we have hope and trust, if we've trusted Jesus as the Savior and admitted our faults, that this life is not all that we are going to experience, but that we will get to experience a more permanent home when Christ comes again to bring the new heaven, usher in the new heavens and the new earth, and we get to spend eternity with God, free from all the evil, because Christ has defeated it already on the cross. And he's going to usher in that more permanent home. And for some of us, where we feel the weight of sin and death and evil and pain and suffering, we need to be reminded of this place. We need to be reminded that what we are experiencing in this life is not the final answer if we do and if we believe what Jesus says in the last half of that verse, and that is this, that I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one can come to the Father except through me. Jesus is our pathway. He's the victorious one who will provide us a heavenly home. So today I want to encourage you to think about this. The two themes that we see in this passage. One, have we kind of had a subtle kind of lowered the impact of sin in our lives? Have we not really given evil its full due? Do we not acknowledge how horrendous of an impact it can have? And maybe one of the challenges is that we need to say, maybe I'm flirting with as close to evil as I can get, and I need to focus again on more getting as close to God as I can. Because evil is a hot fire, and I don't want to try and touch it, because it's going to have that negative impact on my life. For others of us, maybe the challenge, and maybe I think they both apply, we need to look at this other thing, and we need to remind ourselves that God is always at work around us, that Christ has defeated evil, he has defeated sin, and he will provide us a heavenly home, because that is the hope that we need to hang on to this morning. That's the themes that we see in our passage today, and that's our challenge, to walk in this tension always as believers. Let's pray.